Mike McEntee live here on AM 950. If things sound a little bit goofy today, it's because we're remote, so sometimes we have some audio issues. But I am live with you here today and talking about one of the top Republican candidates for governor is calling it quits. Yeah, Matt Dean threw in the towel today. We're going to talk about what that does to the wide open race for governor a little bit later on the show. Plus, who should you really blame for the three-day government shutdown? Yeah, that guy in the White House, but it's not the guy you're probably thinking about. We'll talk with John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, on who's really engineered that shutdown. But first, as you look up and drive to work, you may see the light, a bunch of lights with a message. It's being engineered by Indivisible Light Brigade. It's part of the Indivisible Minnesota 3 group. And joining me to talk about that, let's check here. We've got a couple of guests here actually today who have been with Minnesota Indivisible and working on this project. We've got Anita Smithson and Maya Olson. Let's see if we can get you both on the air here. Hello, Anita. Hello, Maya. Are you there? There's Anita.
Hi,
hello,
this is
Anita.
Anita. I'm here.
Good to have you on, and we're trying to get, and we've got Anita, as we've got Maya as well. Hello, Maya. Are you there?
Hi, yes, I am. Thank you for having us.
Okay, good. We got everybody hooked up. Wonderful. So as I was mentioning, folks may have seen on the freeway and also maybe on the TV news, lights above the freeway giving them a message, and you have been kind of engineering this. This is to get the word out on various topics on Eric Paulson, on various issues. And why don't you tell me, Anita, where did this whole idea come from?
Actually, if you don't mind, I would like Maya to talk about that, as she's the one who came across the lights.
All right, Maya, where did this come from?
Hi. Well, I actually saw it on Twitter. So I was on Twitter, and there was a healthgov.org website that I follow in California, or they shared a Lightbridge Brigade post from California. And I saw it, and I just sent the message to our Indivisible group thinking, you know, we are activists, and we are creative activists with people who just go for it. When we come up with an idea that we like, we just go for it. And so I sent the message, and sure enough, we were that weekend in Anita's garage, you know, drilling and hammering away and getting our first letters made.
Your first letter. So these are signs that are made up of individual letters with lights. How the heck do you make those things?
And that one I'll let Anita answer, because when I sent the text to, there's a group of us that had to approve of it and come up with, you know, how can we finance this and where can we do this? And Anita said we could do it in her garage with her husband's help, which was fabulous. And she has a heated garage. And so she looked up the how-to video, so I'll let her explain that to you.
Okay, go ahead, Anita.
Yeah, the original Overpass Light Brigade group is out of Wisconsin, and they put together a really well-produced video and a how-to tutorial using a Creative Commons license. And they have been incredibly helpful whenever I've had questions about where they sourced something or how they troubleshooted something. They've answered, you know, within the day of how they were able to work past those little issues. But each letter is made from corrugated plastic, which we poked. We had some large templates printed up of the letters, poked holes through, drilled them through, and then poked through the Christmas lights, made a frame, and glued them on. And they're each 2 foot by 3 foot, but they're incredibly light, which makes it easy for people to hold them out on the overpasses.
So you end up with a bunch of letters. What do you use them to spell out? What's the message that you're trying to get out there? I don't know. Anita, you want to try that one?
Yeah. So we initially wanted to get a message about the DREAM Act out. When we made these on December 3rd, it was very critical at that point with the continuing resolution that was expiring that following week. We really wanted a DREAM Act message. So we have 25 letters at this point. And we can play a little bit of Scrabble with what we're going to spell with them. But the specific messages we've used so far are Pass the Dream Act, Defend Truth, and Tax Scam. Although we do have a few other messages up our sleeves that we can use at a future date if the need arises for it. And we've got plans to hopefully fund some additional messages. The winter still has at least a good 6 weeks left, so we'll be able to get out there in the darkness and people will be able to see us. And then again in the fall, we'd like to get out some get-out-the-vote type messages leading up to the November election.
Now, we should point out here, you're talking about the DREAM Act, and Eric Paulson, the representative in Minnesota's 3rd Congressional District, does not support the DREAM Act, as far as I understand. Is that what you're trying to get to here?
Yeah, we think it's incredibly important that Congress passes a DREAM Act. Eric has released a statement, Eric Paulson has released a statement that he supports DREAMers, but has yet to vote on the bipartisan bill, which is H.R. 3440. He instead supports a bill that has just Republican co-sponsors at this point and is more restrictive. So the bill that has been proposed multiple times in Congress and that we would like to see passed is H.R. 3440. I believe they should have the votes, but the Republican leadership doesn't seem to want to bring it to a vote.
So, Maya, what are you hoping that these lighted signs are going to do? What kind of reaction are you getting to this when you're out there waving these signs in the dark? So I should point out this is probably the early morning hours or evening hours.
Early morning and also at rush hour in the evening. And I have to say that at first people said, you know, it's going to be really cold. And my son happens to be a Nordic skier. I'm used to standing out in the cold. And I said, if we dress right, my husband always says there's no such thing as too cold. There's only people who don't dress for it. So I said, we just have to dress really warm. And I tell you, people, they are surprised how much fun they have. And we're actually not waving them around. We're just holding them. And we are having, we're gaining attention. And what we really want to do is our first one, Pass the Dream Act. We had to get enough people to hold each letter, and that's quite a long message, but we decided we could have DREAM Act if not enough people, or we could have Pass DREAM Act, or we could have Pass the DREAM Act, depending on how many people. And I just, you know, I found a bridge on Xerxes Avenue going over 494, and I just said, you know what, I'd just like to start, I think this is a good bridge, we'll start it on Tuesday at, you know, at rush hour in the evening, and we'll just see who shows up. And we had, you know, we had people showing up, and we have people showing up every single time one of us throws out there that, okay, I'm going to do this bridge at this morning or this evening. It just always works out. We've been very lucky. And then Anita and I, at the women's rally, you know, the Women's March Minnesota at the Union Depot, she wanted to do it there with our second message that we had on the bridges, which was, or maybe it was our third message. Yeah, we did Tax Scam, and then we did Defend Truth. And she wanted to take it to the women's rally. So we ended up with only two of us, but we just made it work. We leaned the letters against a wall. So we are can-do people. I tell you, we can make it work. And we've had a lot of fun with it, and the cold hasn't stopped us. The only thing that has ever stopped us is we had to cancel this week because it was the first time out of, Anita, you said, how many times have we had a light bridge? 15?
Yeah, we've been out 15 times so far.
And we only had to cancel because there was a mountain of snow where we normally park our cars and walk to the bridge, and then the bridge was completely buried under this, you know, record amount of snow. So we didn't have a choice. That's the only time we have canceled.
Now, Anita, we mentioned here there was one of the messages that you took down to the Women's March, the women's event that was at the St. Paul Union Depot, was Defend Truth. That's an interesting choice for a message. Tell me what that means to you and what people get out of that.
Well, I think Defend Truth means so many different things to everyone, and that's what's so universal about the message. From a Minnesota 03 Indivisible standpoint, we are incredibly concerned about the attacks on the free press. And the sort of the fake news mentality. So to us, the defend truth message is really important. And with the Women's March Minnesota event on Sunday, the defend truth message kind of went in hand in hand with their hear our voice message. In partnering with them with this message, you know, defend the press, defend the truth of what the policies may be hurting the residents of Minnesota and the United States, and then defend the truths that we know to be powerful, that we need more representation in government, that we need policies that work for the people, not the corporations. And so the message is really universal, and it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and that's why I really like it. The first time that our Light Brigade brought that message out onto an overpass, it was in the morning, and we tend to get less honks in the morning. I don't know if people haven't had their coffee yet, or if when we start, the morning rush hour is flowing a little bit faster, so it might just not feel natural to honk as you're, you know, going down the highway at 45 or 50 miles an hour. But we did have one person in the stopped traffic roll down his window and scream some obscenities, and that he voted for Trump and he was proud to. And so even though the defend truth message can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people, it clearly meant something to him. And it was an interesting response that he had, but it reinforced the belief that the message is the right one to have out there, and we're proud to display it.
It's Trump voters being a little bit defensive there when it comes to truth. An interesting development. Maya, how many people do you have involved in this? Because you mentioned that you, at some point, you're worried whether or not you had enough people to hold up all the letters. If you do a big message these days, do you got enough people to do that?
Oh, easy. Well, I can tell you, first of all, we're definitely more than 50 and indivisible. So we just put out a message that this is where we're going to be. And with people's, you know, work schedules and depending on the location of the bridge, you know, who can come out we've started to have kind of regulars in Bloomington, and then there's regulars in Minnetonka. And we'd like it to travel and go further north. I know they're planning to go on up to Brooklyn Park coming up. And I'm not sure that I'm thinking that the last question you asked me had more than one part, and I'm not sure that I answered you about, you asked me what I hope to accomplish with Pass the Dream Act, our first time that we went out there. And I think gaining attention, and Anita probably answered that in her in her answer, but we want to have people see it and wonder, what is that? And we did find that there were a lot of people who did not know what Pass the Dream Act even meant at the time. I think more people know now. But when we first started this in early December, we had people that asked us, so what does this mean? And so that's a perfect reason to have it out there, because we want people to be aware and look it up and learn about it. Now I hope most of the people understand who Dreamers are and why we want to help protect them.
Well, let me ask you a pragmatic question here. Anita, maybe you can field this one. You know, this is during rush hour. This is a lot of traffic out there. Have you had any pushback from the police concerned about public safety with this? Because I know sometimes sign waivers, there's regulations or, you know, the police don't let you do it. Have you had any problems with that?
So there are regulations regarding overpass or bridge protests, and the main one is that you can't attach anything to the bridge. So outside of that, it generally is a protected First Amendment right. And we actually have been calling the police in the cities in which we plan to demonstrate, just to give them a heads up. And they've been really fabulous, very, very respectful of us calling and giving them a heads up. We have had a few times where officers or state patrol have stopped by and verified that we hadn't had anything actually attached to the bridge, and have asked some questions. But for the most part, we've been very privileged in that we've been able to continue with our message without any issues.
Mm-hmm. So the very first Bridge Brigade when I called both Edina and Bloomington, because the bridge connects the two cities, they actually thanked me for letting them know and just asked some questions about blocking the sidewalk. We're not blocking the sidewalk. We're not blocking the street. And then we received permission from the business where we parked our cars.
This sounds like a really interesting and unique way to get out a message. It's attention getting. Obviously, got our attention. You've gotten some of the other media's attention. If we've gotten people's attention who want to get involved, Maya, how can people get involved? How can they get in touch with you?
Well, we do have a website and a Facebook page, Indivisible.
Can I jump in with this one, Maya?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Sure.
We have, if you go to Facebook, facebook.com/MN03OLB, that's the Facebook page for our Overpass Light Brigade, and our events will be posted there as public invites at this point. They used to be more of a private or email based, but since we've been able to get some attention and get some people who aren't connected involved, we've started putting them on that website. So that would be one good place for people to check out where we're going to be at and how to get involved. Reach out to us there.
All right. Maya Olson and Anita Smithson, I appreciate you coming on today and talk about this stuff. I know it's maybe a little bit out of everybody's comfort zone to get out there and do something, but that's what you have to do these days because that's where we are. Anita and Maya, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity to share
a
message.
Sure thing. And by the way, again, that is on Facebook. If you just Google, just go on the Facebook and look up MN03OLB for Overpass Light Brigade. You will find this group and you're going to be able to connect with them. Well, coming up next here on the Mike McEntee Show, we are going to talk about the governor's race and who's not in it and what that means to the race in the future. That's all coming up here on the Mike McEntee Show on AM 950.
Hello, this is Ellen Krug with Hidden Edges Radio on Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. Join me this Sunday for an interview with Todd Feske, who founded Walking with a Purpose Minnesota, and who will share about how he fell into creating an organization to help the homeless. It's an inspirational story about a human who wants to help other humans. Isn't that what it's all about? Hidden Edges Radio, challenging, passionate, perspective-changing. On AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Congratulations, you survived the holidays. Now what about cleaning up that holiday mess? Fortunately, right now is the best time of the year to call Zero Res and let their professionals do their empowered water thing. Why? Because Zero Res is having a holiday hangover sale. This month you can get 3-room Zero Res clean starting at only $119. Plus this month you can still get a great deal when you get your air duct Zero Res clean. Call 952-ZERO-RES or visit ZeroResMN.com. Zero Res, spell it backward or forward, it spells the same.
This is Bill McLeslie, owner of IP House in Minneapolis. Many businesses don't know their cloud server is unsupported until they actually need support. It takes only one bad experience in dealing with the big name providers to see why I started IP House. We provide support no matter which cloud you're on, theirs or ours. Our staff is located right here in the Twin Cities and is on call 24 hours a day. And if you don't want the cloud, we can help you there too. Call us, 612-337-6337.
With all the convenient big box stores that sell appliances, why do so many Minnesotans choose Warner Stellion? Check online to learn that Warner Stellion is a Minnesota family-owned business for over 60 years. Warner Stellion sells more brands than anyone else, and our passionate specialists are committed to impressing you so much that you'll refer us to everyone you know. That's our mission here at Warner Stellion. Ask around. Check us out online. And when it's your time to buy appliances, join over 300,000 Minnesota homeowners and choose the specialists, Warner Stellion.
It's Mike McEntee back here on AM 950 with the Minnesota headlines. A little more than a month ago, he was leading Republican contender for governor. Representative Matt Dean took first place in a straw poll of Republican Party activists, winning just over 30% in a very crowded field. Well, today, Dean called it quits, citing a lack of campaign resources. And it doesn't help that a Star Tribune poll of Minnesota voters gave him only 2% of the vote. So Dean threw his support behind the guy who lost the gubernatorial race in 2014, Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson, who was second in the Star Tribune poll among Republican candidates with 24%. Third place went to a guy who isn't even running, House Speaker Kurt Dowd. First place, though, went to undecided with 54%, which indicates none of the candidates in the Republican side of the race are well-known or inspiring voters yet. Well, that's probably one of the reasons Dean said, quote, "We must move forward with a candidate who can quickly scale up when endorsing Johnson." Republicans need to move fast to get momentum behind someone, anyone, if they have any hope of winning. And it's notable that none of the Republicans running for governor have released any fundraising totals. Most of the Democrats running have, and while they aren't mind-blowing big, they are respectable. So you have to wonder, are the Republicans generating donations? We know Jennifer Carnahan, the Republican Party chair, is making money off of the donations going to the party, and those are up significantly this year. But for the individual candidates, they may be struggling, and that may be one of the reasons that Matt Dean pulled out. Tomorrow, the Minnesota's executive branch is issuing its sexual harassment prevention policy and procedures report. While that sounds kind of dull, this is, of course, what was prompted by the revelations of sexual harassments at the legislature and at the Capitol. Two legislators have resigned under a cloud of sexual misconduct allegations. Representative Tony Cornish, who is a Republican, and Senator Dan Schoen, a Democrat. Now, that was all prompted by an investigation by MinnPost, which also found inconsistencies on how top officials handle reports of sexual harassment, including inconsistencies in punishment. It will be interesting to see what this report brings out about that. And we have, since we're talking about crime and punishment, the incarceration rates have dropped in most states over the last 8 years, but in Minnesota, they're up. That is according to a new study from the Pew Charitable Trust. We get more now from reporter Laurie Stern.
A new study from the Pew Charitable Trusts found that incarceration rates fell across the nation from the record high 10 years ago. Crime rates also fell. While the crime rate in Minnesota has also dropped, the incarceration rate has risen slightly. Kelly Mitchell with the Robina Center for Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota is co-author of a forthcoming paper that asked why Minnesota's prison population keeps rising.
We are exceeding the capacity of our prison space, housing probably about 500 inmates per year in jails because they don't have enough space at the prison to house everyone that's coming in.
Between 2008 and 2016, the state's crime rate dropped 24%, while the incarceration rate rose 1%. Mitchell says Minnesota also has one of the nation's biggest problems in locking up a disproportionate number of people of color. She says that's largely because of what she calls an accumulation of criminal history. And she says the new study suggests the need for reform in both sentencing and policing. The Robina paper explains that Minnesota laws created felony-level charges for sexual assault, multiple DWIs, and illegal possession of firearms. Co-author and law professor Richard Fraze says it might be time to consider less punitive alternatives for those convictions.
A state that isn't lowering its prison populations at this point in history should be asking itself, why not? Are there people that other states have decided don't need to be in prison that we're still putting in prison?
Fraze and Mitchell emphasize that despite the rise, Minnesota's incarceration rate is still low compared to other states. It's the trend, they say, that's troubling. I'm Laurie Stern, Minnesota News Connection.
Well, here's one trend that really isn't troubling. It's a good trend. The Metro Green and Blue Lines broke ridership records with a 4% increase in ridership, and the North Star Commuter Rail Line shattered ridership expectations by posting an increase of 11.6%. So much for the, that will never work here, about choo-choo trains in the Twin Cities. People do like to ride the rail. Well, coming up next, we're going to talk about the government shutdown and who's to blame for it. And it's not anybody that you might have think that we've mentioned so far. The Democrats, Republicans, that guy in the White House, Trump. Nah, there's somebody else who might have engineered all that. We'll talk about that right after we hear from this.
Laura Hedlund with a Food Freedom Moment. The only person to win a Nobel Peace Prize from the University of Minnesota was Norman Borlaug. Norman's incredible hard work, when he was not given funding, he hand-plowed, led to the Green Revolution, which is credited with saving millions of lives. However, this technical industrial approach to farming has also led to increased use of pesticides, soil degradation, dead zones, nitrates in the water, and a shift around the globe to bigger and bigger farms. Under Reagan, American farmers were told to get big or get out. This Saturday at 8 a.m., Food Freedom Radio will be talking live with author Charles C. Mann, who has just released The Wizard and the Prophet, to remarkable scientists and their dueling visions to shape tomorrow's world. Mann compares the wizard vision of people like Norman Borlaug to the prophet approach as reflected in the vision of a network of self-sufficient citizens guided by ecological realities. The approach advocated by many in the organic movement encourages small farms working with nature, building soil, clean water, and creating food systems that responsibly flow to the next generation. Mann's earlier book included 1491, The New Revelations of America Before Columbus, and that won the National Academy's Communication Award for Best Book of the Year. His newest book is a deep study in the food system and energy systems. So, for example, those who accept the vision of the wizard approach calculate spraying a few million tons of sulfur will reduce the impact of climate change via geoengineering. Those who follow the ecological vision calculate that transforming just 1 acre of desert through carbon farming can offset the carbon of 60 Americans. Mann's book starts with this interesting quote, "No wonder they disagreed so endlessly. They were talking about different things." Food Freedom Radio will be live with Charles C. Mann to talk about his new book on Saturday, January 27th at 8 a.m. Join Food Freedom Radio on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota.
Who's your most trusted companion? Who's with you 24/7? What do you never leave home without? Your phone. But the screen is shattered. Don't panic. Bring it to Computer Revolution with Cell Phone Repair. We have over 18 years experience fixing computer devices, all brands, all carriers. We'll replace that screen and have it back same day. Computer Revolution with Cell Phone Repair in Roseville at Highway 36 in Fairview. Or call 651-633-6600. We fix phones. Same day, 7 days a week.
Tap, taste, and treasure at Vinaigrette, where we have some warm seasonal recipes all ready to create dynamite meals. Our fig balsamic vinegar pairs perfectly with roasted Brussels sprouts or baked brie. And sweet potatoes are always a winner, but never more than when they're roasted with a drizzle of vinaigrette cinnamon or orange-fused extra virgin olive oil on top. Come in today for more custom-crafted food and cocktail recipes at Vinaigrette, 50th and Xerxes in Minneapolis, and 287 Water Street in downtown Excelsior. Online at vinaigrettemn.com.
With your AM950 weather, this is Eric Nelson. Tonight, mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly clear with a low around 30. Friday, mostly sunny with a high near 42. Friday night, partly cloudy with a low around 25. Saturday will be mostly sunny with a high near 33 and a low around 10. Celebrate the resistance and the excitement building towards the 2018 elections with the Blue State Ball, taking place Saturday, March 10th at the Blaisdell in Minneapolis. Confirmed guests include Tom Hartman, Norman Goldman, Matt McNeil, Mike McDee, and lots more. General admission is from 7 to 11 p.m. Tickets available at the door.
Hey, it's Mike McIntyre back on AM 950. You know, you're probably looking for someone to blame for the 3-day government shutdown. Should you blame Democrats, Republicans, President Trump? Well, they all had some influence on what happened. But the biggest influence may have been Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly. John Nichols of The Nation, the national affairs correspondent for them, joins us now to talk about that and some other stories. Hey, John, how are you doing today?
It's great to be with you, brother.
Good to have you on. You know, I was reading your story here, and you've got some insightful insights. Isn't that redundant? You have some insights here on John Kelly. What's going on in the White House? Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I wrote a book on all these guys, and so I had the nice thing about writing a book is that you get time to look at people and look into their background and also kind of ponder them, ponder where they're headed. And the conclusion I came to pretty early on, and I don't think I'm alone in this now, although I think initially there were some different opinions, is that John Kelly is a far more right-wing, extreme right-wing, than I think a lot of people imagined. I think there's this assumption that if he's a general, he's maybe kind of conservative, but not, you know, far out there on the right. And then the other assumption is that he's a good manager, that he knows how to organize things and at the very least would put stuff together well. And I don't think he's either of those things. I think he is, in fact, extreme right winger, and I don't think he's a particularly good manager. I think that he has risen to power and holds that power now primarily because he's a yes man to Donald Trump. He literally tells Trump what Trump wants to hear, and in some cases goes to the right of where Trump is. And this is an important thing to understand, because the fact of the matter is that as you try to figure this all out, what you're going to see is that Kelly, as long as he is there, will continue to empower right-wingers. People like Stephen Miller, who's extremely right-wing, but also people, other folks within the administration who are very much off the deep end, frankly, on a lot of issues like immigration and a host of other social and economic issues. And you just got to be careful with the assumption that somehow if Kelly shows up, things are going to go well. There's no evidence of that. In fact, the historical evidence, at least the recent history, is that if Kelly shows up, things are going to go worse.
So circle around. Tell us how you think that really led to the shutdown that we saw, or that enabled it, our three-day shutdown.
Yeah. You know, look, I don't think it's a secret to your listeners who've been following this whole thing for a long time that there's an awfully lot of evidence that Donald Trump responds to the last person he talks to, right? And, you know, if I sent you in there this afternoon, who knows what you could talk him into? Probably single-payer health care, right? and so we know that he doesn't know a lot about these issues, doesn't know a lot about the structural challenges on, you know, things like the Dreamers versus DACA, that there are different numbers, that, you know, how you draw up an immigration reform plan, you know, really does come down to where you put periods and where you put commas. I mean, Trump doesn't understand any of that. And so when somebody like a Chuck Schumer comes in and says, hey, I got some ideas for you, how about this? There's a very good chance that Trump's going to say, well, that sounds pretty good. Why don't we do that? And it's clear that on the Friday before the shutdown, Schumer made that play. It was his assumption that he could step in, put that on the table, and potentially, you know, swing the day. But it's quite clear that Kelly and Stephen Miller being the extreme right wing, former aide to Jeff Sessions, now White House counselor type character, that they intervened at that point and basically signaled that to Trump, no, you don't want to do this. You don't want to look for this compromise. And it's pretty clear that Kelly played a critical role in preventing Trump from looking for some sort of way out of this thing, move Trump to the side. As Trump was moved to the side, that very much empowered Mitch McConnell. Because, and this gets to who you're going to blame, you can blame a lot of people here. The Democrats they just did not have the courage or the wherewithal to go beyond that weekend. And so if there wasn't a deal to be cut, you know, talking to Trump, talking to, you know, kind of in an emergency situation, pulling everybody together, trying to get an idea through, McConnell was going to have the upper hand. And McConnell is the status quo or worse. And I think things ended up there with the, you know, handed off to McConnell. And I think that, frankly, my sense is that's what Kelly and Stephen Miller wanted, because they know full well that, especially as you're talking about these immigration issues, you're not going to get a good solution out of this, you know, thing delaying. Delaying this into February doesn't make things better for those of us who might want to have a really strong response in favor of the Dreamers and, frankly, on a host of other issues. So my sense is that Kelly, Miller, a certain coterie within the White House, with some collaboration with McConnell, ended up, you know, preventing a compromise.
So with that kind of dynamic going on there at the White House, and yesterday, remember, Trump just offhandedly said, oh, Dreamers could be allowed to morph into citizens. What's going to happen with DACA? Are we going to have another shutdown? What's your thoughts on that?
You know, look, this is one of those things that gets down to the intersection of political movements and political parties. The movement on behalf of the Dreamers is huge. And in fact, it's bigger now than it was a month ago.
And polling shows us a fascinating thing, that as the shutdown fight played out, people didn't turn against the Dreamers. Democratic base turned toward them. There's more enthusiasm now for doing something than there was before. So the fact of the matter is that I think Democratic Party leaders in the House and Senate are going to face some real pressure here. And I just don't think, I don't think it's likely that McConnell is going to give them a bill that's realistic. I know there are negotiations going on, and you know, it's possible they could get to something. You never rule it out. But I think it's very unlikely, and it's certainly not going to come from McConnell himself, who's, there's no evidence that he's particularly determined to do the right thing on this, and he does control that Senate. And then you also have the problem of dealing with the House. And remember, in the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan doesn't have control of his caucus. So there's a substantial portion that's far more militant than he is on immigration issues. So you got a mess there. The likelihood that out of that mess, you get a clean bill or get legislation that somehow really resolves the circumstance of the Dreamers, which, by the way, you're talking about a bigger group than just those who signed up for DACA. You have many, many millions of people who potentially fall into this category. And to get some sort of good response for all of them, I think I find it hard to see how you get there in a non-shutdown situation or in a non-emergency situation. You might end up with a really bad compromise without that. But if you're really talking about a sort of clear resolution, I don't imagine that that will come easily. So I'm not advocating per se for another shutdown. Hopefully you could find a much easier, much happier way to get there. But if I'm going to tell people to be realistic, what I have to say is that I think that Democrats, progressives have to be prepared for that kind of fight, and they can't back away like they did this last time, because every time you back away from a fight, you empower the other side.
We're speaking with John Nichols, who's the national affairs correspondent for The Nation. Now, you also wrote that the shutdown that we're talking about wasn't the most important story of the week. You and I both covered the Wisconsin uprising in Madison, the citizen pushback against Wisconsin.
We sure did.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said we sure did. I'm very honored to have been a part of that with you.
Yeah, that was quite a thing, quite an interesting coverage, because a lot of the legacy media had left town and we were still there covering it when it all broke loose. And that was, of course, tens of thousands of people pushing back against Governor Scott Walker, marching in Madison. And this week in Wisconsin, we saw not marching, but voting. And you write that this may be the beginning of the end for the congressional Republican majority. Tell us about that.
I truly believe that. I don't think there's any question. Remember, when we look at national politics, it's very Washington-centric. It's often defined by the money as well as the strategies that come out of Washington. But when you get into state legislative races, especially for state Senate seats, which are quite big, and you know, a lot of people live in them, a lot of sometimes rural-urban combinations, you get a real signal on where things are at. And in the 10th state Senate district in Wisconsin, which is not far from the Twin Cities, in fact, quite influenced by Twin Cities media, you had a special election for a seat in the state Senate, a large seat that stretched over many counties and a large section of western into near northern Wisconsin. This is an area that voted heavily for Donald Trump. He won by 17% of the vote. In fact, you can say that this state Senate district and those around it really gave Trump the state of Wisconsin. If it hadn't been for those large margins in those areas, Trump wouldn't have carried Wisconsin. And the previous Republican state senator there had won by even bigger margins. She won by 26% of the vote, the 26% margin in 2016. So she left, the seat was vacant, called a special election. The Democratic candidate up there is a newcomer to politics who had served on the local school board and had done, like community stuff. There was an active person in the county where she lived as a medical examiner. Well, she ran a good campaign, no question about it. She ended up winning by 11 points. Now, mm-hmm. I don't know how good you are at math. If you take a 26-point margin for the Republicans a year and a half ago, you end up with an 11-point margin for the Democrats this month. That's a 37% swing to the Democrats. And I don't care how you want to add that, by the way, the Republican candidate was a very credible state representative, good candidate, no question of that. You get a 37% swing to the Democrats in a circumstance like that. It's not just about the candidates. It's not just about the issues in play. It really is a signal that people are ready to try something else. And final point I'll make with you. This is the 34th Republican legislative seat to flip since Trump became president. So there's a tremendous amount of evidence out there that people are hungry to vote for a progressive alternative. And if this continues into the fall, the Republicans cannot withstand 37% swings. They can't withstand swings of half that and maintain their control of the House of Representatives.
I think it's interesting that you point out in these races that have flipped that most of the candidates have been women.
There's no question of this, and I think we have to take this into our calculus as we think about politics here. There have been women in politics for 100 years, and they've accomplished incredible things, but they have never had parity, rarely had parity, and as a result, we've had a male-dominated politics in this country. You had a woman who ran for president of the United States in 2016. She may not have been a perfect candidate, but there's simply no question that part of why she was beaten, remember she got almost 3 million more votes, but part of why she was beaten was a tremendous amount of sexism, literally attacks on her that were absurd and unfair. And I do believe that Trump coming to power as a guy whose own storyline need not be repeated because it's so awful. I think it's inspired a tremendous number of women, A, to step up as candidates, and there's an incredible number of women running for legislative seats, congressional seats, Senate seats, governorships, and also for women who don't choose to run for office to get engaged, to really believe it is important to step up and get out and vote, do organizing, do activism. And I just think that we should recognize the fact that women are stepping up. They're, you know, really kind of undergirding and underpinning the resistance to Donald Trump. And we shouldn't doubt for a second that they will be at the forefront of the electoral resistance. The evidence from these legislative races, I think, confirms that.
Hey, I got one more for you. Here in Minnesota, we lost a big defender of net neutrality when Al Franken resigned. But you're writing about a new defender of net neutrality in Montana that actually other states, other locals, you know, other cities might want to take a look at. Tell us about that.
Well, you better. Yeah, in fact, we might have to make another place on our list of potential 2020 presidential candidates for Steve Bullock out of Montana. He's the governor out there, and Montana's not always in the headlines. But Bullock is a former attorney general. He knows his way around the law. He's a Democrat in a kind of state that voted pretty heavily for Trump. He knows how to win in tough places. He also knows his state well. He knows the issues that matter. And what he did is a fascinating thing. He sat down and read the FCC's terrible decision on net neutrality. And as a lawyer, he said, look, you know, there's an opening here. And the opening is that a governor probably can't reinstate net neutrality, may not have that power. But a governor does have the power to say who the state will contract with. The governor can issue an executive order saying, we won't do any contracts with telecoms, with providers of internet service that don't guarantee net neutrality. And of course, once companies in a state, remember states are very big purchasers of the services of telecoms, once companies in a state, if you're required to do net neutrality to contract with the state, I mean, you got net neutrality. And he issued an executive order. It's a well-written, very detailed order that goes into the specifics of how you guarantee net neutrality. And he then also created a template and said, I hope other governors and mayors and other people around the country will do the same. And this isn't the answer to the net neutrality fight. We need a universal solution that guarantees net neutrality, the First Amendment of the Internet, for all Americans. We desperately need that. We can't fool around with that. However, in this period where we're struggling to build the majorities for it, to begin to undo this horrible FCC ruling, having states step up like this is a big deal. And what Bullock in Montana did, it's frankly inspiring. It's hopeful.
It is. It is absolutely inspiring, and it's a hope. It's another avenue here that maybe Governor Dayton here and some other cities here in Minnesota mm-hmm. might take a lesson from and fight back. John Nichols from The Nation joins us here. John, we have to run, but I appreciate always talking to you and getting updated on all the stuff that you cover.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. You guys do a great job. I wish we had a station like you in every city, big city in the country.
We wish too. Thank you much, John.
All right, brother. I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Take care. Oh, well, coming up here next on the Mike McEntee Show, Congressman Eric Paulson, an ad supporting him, has one embarrassing detail in it, and we'll talk about it coming up here next on the Mike McEntee Show on AM 950.
. 2018 is the year women make real change. Northern Sun, the progressive voice of protest since 1979. And this year, we're the fuel driving the women's marches across the country. Northern Sun, the one-stop shop for shirts, stickers, buttons, and posters. Make a statement. Sticker it to the man. Visit Northern Sun in Minneapolis on East Lake Street or online at northernsun.com.
The number one source of the Twin Cities gay scene is All Digital. Follow Twin Cities Gay Scene on Facebook and Twitter. Sign up for the Scene Shot email blast for weekly updates and chances to win great prizes. No app is needed to view the bi-weekly web editions of Scene. It's GLBTQ media for the mobile generation. Find it all at TwinCitiesGayScene.com. That's TwinCitiesGayScene.com.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for nearly 45 years, invites you to shop their two convenient locations, both offering the strong commitment to local producers and healthy foods you've come to expect. Seward focuses on locally grown and raised products, fair trade, and environmental sustainability. Shop their selection of meats, artisan cheeses, and house-made baked goods. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store on 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.coop.
Hi, I'm Dr. Scott Chamblot from Chamblot Family Dentistry. We're the fear-free, get-you-out-of-pain-now dental office.
And I'm Rachel Chamblot. Did you know a lot of people are afraid of the dentist? You don't need to be afraid of my dad. He makes going to the dentist comfortable and even fun.
We don't care if you're a dental regular or haven't seen a dentist in years. We just want to make you comfortable and get you out of pain.
If you don't see my dad, please see another dentist. Take care of your teeth because they're the only ones you get. Call 1-800-FIX-MY-TEETH or visit fixmyteeth.us.
Hey, it's Mike McEntee back here on AM 950. Former Senator Norm Coleman has this political action committee called the American Action Network. And so he knows what Minnesota looks like. And so it's a little bit embarrassing with the ad that the American Action Network is running supporting Congressman Eric Paulson. You know, they run these ads saying, go thank Eric Paulson for doing X, Y, and Z, because, you know, they can't. It's a way to kind of skirt some of the regulations. They're not saying, you know, the other opponent running against Eric is bad or whatever it may be. But you've seen these ads before. And so the latest ad has a couple sitting there talking about how the tax cut that Eric Paulson helped pass is making their lives all better. And, you know, they go for a walk outside and continue to talk about it. And then you notice that in the background are palm trees. And you're thinking, wow, Minnesota's had some real climate change, hasn't it? No, this is obviously one of those cookie cutter ads. And nobody, you know, they just said, okay, and also say Eric Paulson when you're talking. I mean, they're obviously not constituents of Eric Paulson, unless they got a really big tax break already and moved to Florida. So, you know, this is the kind of stuff you have to watch for, and this is the kind of stuff that happens when big money gets into ads and into politics, I should say, and the candidates don't have control of it anymore. This is what happens. This is another reason you need to support getting rid of Citizens United, because this is the kind of junk that gets out there. I mean, I don't care which candidate it was, but it is, this is the kind of stuff that happens when money gets in politics and it's uncontrolled. The candidates don't control the message. It's other groups saying whatever they want to say, trying to make you believe stuff, and they don't have to tell you the truth. And obviously, this was not a truthful ad. It was not a pair of Eric Paulson's constituents, as they are leading you to believe. Here's another one that is rather amusing. Donald Trump apparently asked, the Trumps themselves asked the Guggenheim, the museum, to borrow a Van Gogh for the White House. Now, this is not too unusual for a request to come in for some art to be used at the White House. But the response that the Trumps got to this was rather unusual. I'm reading here from the Washington Post, which broke the story. It says the emailed response from the Guggenheim's chief curator to the White House was polite but firm. The museum would not accommodate a request to borrow a painting by Vincent Van Gogh that the President Melania Trump had requested for their private living quarters. Instead, the curator, Nancy Spector, wrote that another piece was available, and it was nothing like the one that they had asked for. The curator's alternative, an 18-carat, fully functioning, solid gold toilet. That's an interactive work titled America that critics have been describing as a pointed satire aimed at the excesses of wealth in this country. Now, for about a year, the Guggenheim has exhibited this toilet, again called America, the creation of a contemporary artist, Maurizio Catalan, in a public restroom on a museum's fifth floor for visitors not just to look at, but to use. But the exhibit now was over and the toilet was available. Quote, should the president and the first lady have any interest in installing it in the White House? The White House did not respond to inquiries about this. And on Facebook, Trump's might appreciate the gilded toilet, giving his well-documented history of installing gold-plated fixtures in his residence, his properties, and even his airplane. But he's also a known germaphobe, so it's an open question whether he would accept a previously used toilet, 18-carat or otherwise. Hey, coming up on the show tomorrow, we're going to talk about the 1st Congressional District. There's a lot of candidates on the DFL side. There's going to be a primary on the Republican side. They're trying to prevent a repeat of losing and losing and losing. We're going to be speaking with Rochester Post Bulletin reporter Heather Carlson, who's been following the race, and she'll be with us tomorrow to give us an idea of what's going on as the candidates get ready for the precinct caucuses that are in less than 2 weeks. Come on back tomorrow. We'll see you then.